Hello, and welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based tutoring in your home by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs in the IEP process.
Welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. To follow us on social, you can find us on Instagram at Learning Essentials. Today, we're talking about empowerment through vision with Dr. Nate. Dr. Nate received his doctorate of optometry from Illinois College of Optometry, located in Chicago, Illinois, in 2004. The following year, he completed a residency program specializing in pediatric and binocular vision at the Illinois College of Optometry. During his optometric internship, he studied developmental vision in Denver, Colorado, and contact lenses and ocular disease in Chicago, Illinois. Owing to his passion for improving the vision of children, Dr. Nate has published articles on such topics as the use of vision therapy to improve reading skills and has lectured to optometry students and paraprofessionals, as well as the general public, on visual care of children, the importance of vision in personal development, and options for controlling nearsightedness. Dr. Nate was always smart as a student in Florida public schools, but was a slow reader and standardized tests were intimidating. He always had to work very hard in high school and at University of Florida. When it came to courses at the Illinois College of Optometry, he failed a class because he could not perform the eye exam techniques. One of his faculty members suspected that the root cause was that he had a functional vision problem. This was identified and treated and passed the course. Dr. Nate fell in love with functional vision and made it his life goal to help as many people of all ages as possible. He now practices in Tampa, Florida at his practices, Bright Eyes Family Vision Care and Bright Eyes Kids. Welcome, Dr. Nate, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Wendy. I'm really, I'm honored to be invited, and I'm excited about our conversation.
Absolutely. Let's dive right in. So can you just tell me, what is vision therapy? There's a lot out there on the topic, but I would love to hear from an expert such as yourself of what vision therapy is.
Right. So vision therapy is a little bit of a catch-all term for anything that we can do as professionals to help empower patients to take control of their own visual system. So it's basically kind of like being an eye coach, where we teach children of all different abilities how to increase their awareness of visual perception, how to increase their fine motor visual skill, how to basically use their eyes better to improve their quality of life and meet their goals. And sometimes that is more centered around academic success. Sometimes it's more centered around their quality of life and comfort, if they're either having headaches or other vision type related problems, or sometimes it's more to do with like sports competitiveness and achievement. And so it's a series of activities that are individualized and programmed to help individuals meet their goals.
Does it involve more the physical or a cognitive approach?
Well, like almost everything that I'm probably going to say when we're talking about patients, it absolutely depends on the individual patient and their diagnosis. A lot of it is physical, or at least rooted in physical, because the visual system, the way our eyes learn to perform, is really rooted in movement and development. And so a lot of the type of stimulation that kids get as infants, when we're talking about tummy time and crawling and lots of bilateral activities and stimulation, all of that kind of gross motor and body awareness sort of sets the tone for visual fine motor skill, which in turn affects the visual perceptual skill. So it sort of depends on where the patient is on that continuum. So if they're really, really having problems with tracking, or what I would call ocular motor dysfunction, then we spend a whole lot of time on gross motor body awareness and then work towards eye movement fine control. If their fine movement control and their visual focusing, et cetera, is really good, but they do have visual information processing or perceptual deficits, then it's a lot less body movement and a lot more worksheets and cognitive kind of skill development. So it just really depends on the patient.
If the focus was kind of more school readiness reading that impacts in the classroom, can you walk me through what a session would look like?
Sure. So if I can set the scene just briefly, very many of our patients do not have isolated visual dysfunction or isolated vision problems. Vision is just sort of one piece of a big puzzle of the complex nature of patients. So many, many of our patients have gone through sort of a sequence in their life. You know, maybe around two or three, they might have had some speech therapy. You know, maybe a little bit older, they might have had some OT. And then, you know, as they're sort of getting ready for school readiness, and especially around the ages of like 7 and 8, you know, if their vision isn't really quite performing as well as they need to for the type of academic demands, copying from the board, sustained reading, especially nowadays, there's so much technology both in the classroom and at home, not even counting the e-learners, but even the ones who are in classrooms are, you know, it's so technology, you know, based these days. So that's sort of like our bread and butter, most common patient. Of course, there's differences. So for that kind of patient, a typical session would look like this. They would have one therapist that's pretty much through with them the whole program. So they develop a very close relationship with that patient, and the therapist really get to know sort of the ins and outs of their lives and, you know, kind of what they're going through. So they would sort of get kind of warmed up and sort of socialize a little bit. They would usually take their shoes off, and then they would kind of go over, okay, how did you do with the activities that we assigned you at home? Although we do sessions for 45 minutes once a week, the real benefit of the therapy is the fact that they do about 15 minutes 5 days a week at home, because that gives them ownership of what they're doing at whatever skill level they're at. It could be very, very low. You know, the fact that this is something that they are doing and they are making connections means it's not something that we are doing to them. They don't just show up and we infuse them with vision therapy. We're teaching them skills that they then can practice. So that review of what they've done at home is absolutely critical for each individual session. Then we take those sessions and we add those skills that they've been working on, and we increase the difficulty a tiny bit, just, you know, enough to where your audience, you know, I'm sure is very familiar with this, but, you know, it's all about finding that sweet spot for individual patients. You know, too easy and it's boring, or it's insulting even if it's way too easy, too hard, and then it's just like frustrating and they hate it. So you got to challenge them just enough. And that's really where vision therapists like really shine, is just really knowing, because every patient's different and every day is different. They could be not have slept well, or they could have a change in medication. I mean, there's just so many different variables. So
sounds like the classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like an informal classroom. And we vary it a lot. There's an acronym we use called LOVE, and it's called lots of variety in everything. So we work on individual skills, but in so many different ways that the patient and their brain never gets bored, because we're constantly trying to stimulate them in a variety of ways. And then we prep them to send that home, and then they work on it at home.
And it's so true in terms of finding that sweet spot. And then we say that as special educators and educators in general, just trying to find that sweet spot so the kids aren't bored, but they're not frustrated and shut down. And it is that delicate balance and dance for sure.
Yeah.
How are vision issues diagnosed beyond a simple vision test? You know, kids get a vision test, just their basic intro. And then when would a parent know that something deeper is happening?
Right. So that's a fantastic question. And I want to say one tiny caveat, And that is where it absolutely never shows up, almost never, is in any sort of vision screening at either a pediatrician's office or a school screening, because those aren't even designed to pick up those kinds of problems. Those screenings are designed specifically to pick up kids who are nearsighted or myopic, the kids who are having trouble seeing the board. Well, the reason why that is silly, in my professional opinion, is the kids who are nearsighted, the ones who are bookworms, the ones who are myopic, like they tend to, on average, be advanced performers. Like those are the ones who are doing really well. It's the ones who are farsighted or have functional vision problems who pass all the screenings, but are super struggling when it comes to reading development and other, you know, other issues. And so right off the bat, screenings don't count. Just get that out there. Now, the second thing is, for most people, I can see, our listeners can't see, but I can see you are wearing glasses. So the chances are really good that you've had an eye exam at some point in your life. And the purposes of that is, you know, are primarily, number one, to make sure your eyes are healthy, and if not, to treat it, figure it out, what's going on. And two, make sure that you can see 20/20 at distance and near. And that's pretty much all it is. And it's pretty fast and it's pretty efficient, because most people, that is a certain model that makes a lot of sense. Doctors know it, patients know it, everything just sort of works. What I'm talking about for these sorts of evaluations, I like to call it a visual stress test. It's like a treadmill test for cardio patients, except for it's for the visual system. So it's not necessarily, can you see 20/20? That's necessary, but not sufficient for school readiness. But it's all about, when we ask your eyes to work, how well do they work? And how well are they able to sustain extended hard work? Because it's one thing if kids' eyes can do it for 15 seconds in the exam chair. Boom, your eyes can move, your eyes can focus. Great, you're all good. It's another thing if they can do it for 2 hours or 8 hours. And here's the key thing. As I'm going to say over and over and over again, every child's different, every person's different. So when some people are challenged visually, some people's eyes just shut down. They just shut off. They're just like, nope, I'm not doing this. I'm done. I'm checking out. Some people go into like way overdrive. They have like a hair trigger. Everything just like absolutely like maxes out and redlines. And they also can't function, but they present with different symptoms. There's other people who go into sort of like, for lack of a better word for the audience, sort of like denial, meaning they just sort of like, they have all of these problems, but their brain filters all of them out. And they perform terribly on exams, but they don't present with the same kind of symptoms because they just are sort of checked out from their vision entirely. So these exams are longer and they're a lot more about observation. How are they doing these different things? When I ask them to look at something up close, are they holding it super close? Are they getting really, really tense? Is their breathing getting like super shallow? You know, or do they just look at it and be like, oh yeah, I can see it. Now, we also have very specific tools. We have flashlights called retinoscopes and all of these other fancy things, which allows me as a developmental optometrist to look and see where they are focusing. And this is absolutely key. So I really kind of want to talk about this for a few seconds. There are lots and lots of times where children of all ages, but especially patients who have different types of developmental disabilities, look at something. Say it's a paper in their hand, and they think they are looking at it, but their eyes, because of their poor fine motor control, their eyes are actually focused either far away or about a foot or two behind it. And I can see that with my flashlight. I know literally where they're focusing. Or, you know, conversely, they could be looking at the board and they think they're looking at the board, but their eyes are still focused on the page. So it's all blurry and frustrating for them, even though they can see 20/20 and their eyes are healthy. So there's lots of different ways that we evaluate that sort of autofocus system. And I talked about eye tracking a little bit. That's the most intuitive for parents, because if they can see that their kids' eyes are just not pointing where they need to, if they're just kind of like all over the place, people kind of intuitively understand that. And then the last part that I'll mention is The way the eyes work together, depth perception. If both of the eyes are pointing at the same place, they're sending the same information to the brain can process that spatial awareness, and we have ways to evaluate that. So the whole process is like, you know, depending on the patient, it's like an hour. I mean, it's a lot of work. And I always ask parents when I talk to them afterwards, how was your kid, you know, after when you got in the car and you went home? Because a lot of kids will, you know, they're eager to please. They're great, great, great kids. So they hold it together in here and they work and they do everything I ask and they smile and they're super sweet and they're great. And they get in the car and they absolutely fall apart because it is so difficult. They have, you know, they have headaches, they're exhausted. And if you just watch them, it doesn't seem like any of this is difficult because they're just sitting in the chair looking around. Like, it's not like I'm asking them to do push-ups, but it's so hard for them to coordinate this much effort. And I wouldn't know it because they're so good at masking it and being like delightful that, you know, it's only when they leave and the parents say like, yeah, he was like toast the rest of the day.
It's fascinating to me, this whole conversation. We could speak many hours on this topic. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why I'm so excited to have you here and just thinking about my special education lens, right? Mm-hmm. So you have parents as being in a classroom and then now doing the support that I do through educational therapy and IEP coaching, you have parents say, you know, something's happening and you're absolutely right. I think you mentioned, you know, kids have had, you know, maybe speech or OT or PT, you know, parents are just trying to figure out something is happening, you know, something's going on and that fatigue is so real and 100% agreeing with what you're saying in terms of you have these kids, they're in class. I'm just thinking of what you're explaining as you're doing your process, but I see these kids in class and they're lovely and working so hard, but then they're so fatigued and they fall apart and, you know, and it's trying to figure out what is happening. How would a parent know? How would a teacher know to refer to a visual exam? What would that be called? Like, what are they looking for? What are they asking for? Because I'm sure this is not something like a neuropsych is not going to pick up on this, or would it?
Well, yes and no. So where the neuropsych evaluation may pick up on it is the nonverbal section, because there's definitely some visual processing and spatial awareness things that happen during that evaluation. And the challenge that I see parents having with that specifically is, you know, the neuropsych evaluation is great, and I encourage it frequently. So I don't want anything I'm saying to sound anything other than positive. But the frustration that parents sometimes have is, okay, they do poorly in, you know, the nonverbal section, and there are some accommodations, but there often isn't like a next step. Like, okay, so how do we improve this situation?
Bingo.
And I don't know. And not, I know some, but I don't know, you know, all of them. And I don't even know a lot of, you know, school psychologists or, you know, or pediatric psychologists to, you know, to have that conversation a lot. But anyways, that's one way. It's not the most common way, but it's a most common way. There are some very classic telltale signs. For example, headaches. If the child never wakes up with a headache, but often gets a headache in the afternoon, especially if it's pretty highly correlated with visual work, especially like up close work, either like tablet or like, you know, screen work. And then it kind of goes away when they're done, especially if it sort of starts in the forehead and maybe sort of goes around to the temples. Not always. There's a zillion reasons for headaches, but vision is a big one. You know, if they're doing a lot of rubbing their eyes, not when they're tired, because everybody does that when they're tired. But I mean, just like in general, you know, that's a red flag. But honestly, and I want to say two things about this. If kids just look like they are just not able to kind of do the work, if they sort of start off strong and then 10 minutes later, they sort of, you know, drift out. This is where it absolutely looks like, to parents, not to give dads a bad rap because, you know, I'm a dad, but, you know, to dads, it can look like they're just being lazy. And even to teachers, and even to, honestly, even to excellent special ed teachers, if you don't realize how hard these kids have to work, it can, you know, just sort of appear like they're just kind of not interested, like they're just not applying themselves, even though they're doing their very, very, very best. Quick caveat I'll just say is that little window before they kind of lose confidence. Like at first they're like working really hard and they're into it. And then eventually they sort of are like, oh, maybe I am just dumb. Like maybe I just shouldn't expect myself to do this. Like catching them before then is like absolutely like critical. But I, you know, that's a whole nother thing. So I would say like, so any of those are key. Now I will say this, and you can put a link in the show notes, and I think you will, but there's an organization called College of Optometrists and Vision Development, COVD.org is their website. And they have a symptoms checklist that has been very well studied and, you know, vetted. They have normative data. And what you can do, you can use it in two different ways. One, you can just sort of look through the checklist and see like, wonder how much this sort of fits my child. Now, the younger they are, the more they're going to act like immature people because they are. So you have to take that into account. But you can also like click on the buttons and get a number. And then there are doctors there, you know, that the website can kind of connect you with. I'm one of them, but there's tons of them. Then you can see, you know, if you really need a thorough pediatric evaluation.
What an excellent resource. Thank you for sharing that. And I absolutely put that in our show notes. Does vision therapy have the ability to permanently fix issues, or does it provide strategies to help children overcome the obstacles? So in other words, does vision therapy provide more of a cure or a treatment?
Well, like everything, it depends. So I like to break it this way. This is not true in the very most literal sense, but I like to break it down this way to parents because I think most parents understand this. It depends if they have more of a hardware problem or a software problem. So if it's a software problem, meaning their brain just never quite calibrated their eyes, they think they're moving from one word to another, but they're actually moving three words down. And so that they're skipping and then there's gaps, but they do it so often that their brain sort of filters it out and thinks that that's just how you read. Then that's the type of problem that by improving their awareness, by calibrating their eyes, oh, when I move this much, it looks like this and it feels like this. And with enough practice, I can not only do it, but I can do it over a period of time and I can develop my stamina. And then eventually I can do it while I'm multitasking and I can do it while I'm problem solving. And I can even do it while the teacher's talking and I'm really thinking about a thought, but I'm still copying from the board at the same time. All of that, you know, is happening. So that is an absolute permanent fix. Similarly with the autofocus issue, if they can't copy from the board because it's just too blurry, they can see the board perfectly fine, but then they look down at their page and then they look up at the board and then it's blurry because they focused on their page. Those problems are totally fixable. We fix them, then we give them some maintenance therapy afterwards, and then they come back 3 months later, we quantify all of the exam tests, we confirm, yep, you're exactly as good as you know need to be, you're exactly, you know, average or above average. Because you've sustained it for 3 months, it's assumed that unless if you have some sort of event, which we can also talk about, then you're done, you're fixed. If it's a hardware problem, meaning they either have a physical issue with the muscles of their eyes, the way they were developed, or they have like an actual either congenital or developmental, you know, genetic condition with the way their brain processes information, then it's not going to be a fix. It's going to be adaptive. It's going to be, how can we help you live with this so it minimizes adverse effects to, you know, to your quality of life? And I'll say one more thing about that, which applies to all of our patients, is just as important as developing skills is developing good habits, because, you know, they're not going to be our patients for the rest of their life. They're going to move away. They're going to eventually go to high school. They're going to go somewhere else. You know, different things are going to happen. So the more we can teach them good visual habits to reduce eye strain and reduce the types of problems that they are likely to develop, then the better it is for them in the long term. And I spend a lot of time talking about the race, my finger quotes, the race. To me, the race is, okay, like life is stressful and school is stressful. And even video games are stressful visually, and all of that stress is not great for us visually speaking, meaning we develop bad habits, we adopt poorer posture, we develop all of these issues. And so all of that is going to create problems. Also, through just natural development from living, because we're smart and our kids are amazing, they're going to slowly improve. The question is, you know, which is going to grow more? Is their natural development going to outstrip the rate of problems that they're going to have as school gets more demanding and they have to go from reading individual pages to chapter books or not? And so the whole point about vision therapy is to make sure that they win that race. It all boils down to just that, or at least not make sure, but give them every possible advantage they can to win that race.
Are there certain vision conditions linked to academic difficulties?
Yes. So there's a couple different ways to talk about this. There was a paper done by one of my all-time favorite optometrist vision scientists from Ohio. And what he did is he had gone through, I don't know, hundreds of students who had IEPs, and then did very thorough like visual evaluations and kind of correlated that with just sort of like a pool of like normal or, you know, neurotypical kids. And there were some interesting, you know, findings there, because definitely the kids who were in the IEP needed glasses, you know, more often, especially for farsightedness or hyperopia is the, you know, the word would be used. You know, they also had more challenges with amblyopia and strabismus, what most people would call lazy eye. You know, we don't say lazy eye, but, you know, that just basically means the eyes aren't working together. They may not be aligned. One eye may like dominate, you know, the other. So absolutely those types of conditions appear significantly more frequently in the IEP population than in sort of the mainstream population. So that's just sort of kind of one way to look at it. But on an individual basis, yes, when children have a lot of these, quote, software problems, because it just makes it a lot more work for them. It doesn't mean that they can't read. It doesn't mean that they never learn to read properly. But if their eyes aren't really calibrated for tracking, and they make so many mistakes when they're reading that they have to kind of go back and reread, it so dramatically increases how much time they need and how much fatigue they experience, you know, when they read. And there's basically, you know, correlates to that, to the auto-focusing system. The word that optometrists use is accommodation, but I never use that word because it means totally different things to you and everybody listening to this. So I use autofocus instead of that word, even though that's the word. So when we write reports, we're really careful to try to distinguish the two. So those are exactly the type of problems that we look for. But one more thing, and that is there's a whole other group of people who have problems, and they're not really necessarily the people who would be listening to this podcast, because those are the academic overachievers. Those are the ones who are like gifted, straight A's, super motivated. And then what they do is they wind up through like overuse and stress at an older age, more like high school instead of elementary school, creating a whole set of other developmental problems. We don't need to get into the details of that, but my point is that also affects schoolwork, because if you get headaches so quickly and you just can't even get your homework done when you're used to getting straight A's, that's devastating for, you know, for high achieving kids. And because they work so hard to get it done, it's missed forever. Like they fall through the cracks because Nobody knows how hard they're working, because to everybody, they're smiling and they're polite and they're getting straight A's and they're also playing sports and they're also learning violin. You know what I mean? So why would they possibly be having any problems? But they just can't hold it together forever. So anyways, that's a different group of people, but they're a group that sometimes has a lot of problems.
What are the more common learning-related vision disorders?
Mostly what I've been talking about are the physiological or functional kind of mechanical things, like the brain sends signals to the eye muscles. Do the eye muscles have sufficient fine motor skill to kind of, you know, do what they need to do. But there's a whole separate category, visual information processing or perceptual, visual perceptual skill. And this does sometimes come up in neuropsych reports, and it very often comes up in occupational therapist evaluations. And this is less about, like I said, how the eye muscles work, but it's more about, for lack of a better word, like how visually overwhelmed kids get. Because, you know, there's probably lots of, you know, parents and professionals who would be listening to this who are familiar with the kid who on a flashcard will get the word every time, 10 out of 10 times, totally get it. But then you put that exact same word in a small paragraph, and now all of a sudden they're just like, oh my gosh, I have no idea. Now I have to like either try to sound it out, or I have to, you know, I have to like recall, or I just skip it altogether because, or the most common of all is I just guess. I see the first letter is B, and yeah, so I'm just going to throw in any word that begins with B. You know what I mean? And so kind of what they may be having a problem with is visual figure ground, meaning, you know, they can see the whole thing, but they have a block or a delay in being able to pull out the most relevant thing at that moment. And when you're reading, the most relevant thing changes every second because you're going from word to word to word to word. And it just becomes so completely overwhelming that it's really, you know, really difficult. Visual memory is another one, and that's pretty intuitive to people. Some people just have a very hard time looking at something and sort of like making a picture of it in their mind and then being able to recall it, you know, later. Most people sort of, I think, intuitively get that. Another part of it is visual closure. So that's taking a bunch of individual things and making one mental object out of it. So if you see three dots, just three dots, you can look at it and sort of like, oh, that's a triangle. And it could be a triangle and different. And then your mind doesn't have to work as hard because you just sort of remember triangle instead of three separate things. There's a kind of a famous, well, it's famous to me, optical illusion, which when you first look at it, looks like random rectangles just sort of strewn about. But then when you put it together, it says love, because you can sort of see the individual blocks. And then you can see like, oh, in the contrast, actually the space in between all those, you know, spells out love. This visual closure skill is absolutely important for learning to read, because the whole, well, I mean, I'm not a reading specialist and I don't claim to be, but if you look at a word, especially one that's long, like seven letters long, and what you physically see in your mind are a lot of lines with sticks and crosses and little loops, and then you have to look at each one individually, but you don't visually group it into one object, which is a word, it makes it much harder. So those are all types of things that we would test for, and then we would help patients with, and then we would retest with the idea that as they develop these visual skills, they would become more proficient at reading. So just to be super clear, I don't ever promise anything, because these patients very often have other challenges. But if we can solve part of these problems, then all of the other resources and everything that you are so fantastic about, and all, you know, all the people in the system, all of that, it just makes their job easier, and it makes it less frustrating for the patient. And they do feel empowered, because they're like, oh, look, this is a tiny piece of it that I absolutely learned how to control myself. And I have all these skills, and I have this little, you know, tool belt, or I have more tools to put in my tool belt. And so that's kind of how that fits together.
It certainly sounds that vision therapy can definitely help kiddos with their academic success. How often, and I'm sure it depends on the individual patient or client, how often will they participate in vision therapy? So they come to you and they do the process, and then what does that segment look like?
So it highly, highly depends. The patients who are referred to us from a psychologist or an occupational therapist or another, you know, another optometrist, they are very, very often kind of in a growth mindset, you know, where they like understand like, oh, this is like another piece of the puzzle. And so this is something that, you know, that we can do that, that makes sense. And the good news is, unlike a lot of other sort of developmental type therapies, I mean, because occupational therapy, which is the closest, you know, analog to what I do, is so broad, you know, that can go on for years because there's always sort of a next stage where they, you know, they could do more, but this is a lot more defined. So this is usually like, it's not a trivial amount of time, but it's more like 6 months. It's like, okay, we're gonna do this for a short amount of time. It's gonna pay off, you know, long term. And so the patients who kind of come in that way, very, very, very often, they will do it. And if they can't do it because they travel from long distances, nowadays we can do it online, or it's not quite the same, but we've adapted like really well. And so we can do a lot of it, you know, online, and that helps. One of the downsides is most of the medical insurance plans cover our kind of service poorly, if at all. And so that is an absolute kind of barrier for lots of patients. And so we kind of have systems to where we sort of make it as accessible as possible, because everything is individualized. There's ways that, you know, we can see patients once a month instead of once a week, and we can give them a lot more like information that they can do on their own. We can prescribe other kind of short-term things. Or one of my favorite things to do is if they're already in occupational therapy and they're young and they don't have strabismus or amblyopia, but they might have like an ocular motor problem, is then just kind of work with their OT. So like, OTs are fantastic. Like I can sort of tell them, hey, if you include these sorts of things into what you're already doing, you know, and they'll say, come back in 6 months and, you know, and so we'll sort of see. One of the things that, you know, I don't know the history necessarily, but unlike speech and OT, that, you know, this doesn't exist in schools at all. Now there are teachers for the visually impaired, you know, there's like visual assistants, but not this exact thing. And so that's a big kind of barrier for a lot of patients. So, and then one more thing is, if patients just kind of come in and parents don't know any of this, and they think the absolute worst case scenario is that their child's going to be prescribed glasses, and that's all they know, and if I'm their first stop because they haven't explored all of those other things we talked about, then it is so overwhelming that they need time to process it. They just need time and resources. And so I say, hey, let's go to COVD, look at the information. Here's some another information. Come back in 6 months. We'll sort of regroup, talk to your pediatrician or whatever, like, you know, resource, you know, you have currently, because it's just too much for them. The conversation we're having right now is they're just not ready for it.
Yeah, that's a lot of information to absorb, especially if you're coming in thinking you're getting glasses and then you get a whole other spectrum of information. I love that you collaborate with OTs. You mentioned that. Do you ever collaborate with schools in terms of, you know, kiddos with their IEP, school support, accommodations? Is there any kind of overlap or any way that people could overlap as a school to kind of better serve students that maybe cost could be a barrier, or just in general to better serve a population in need?
So yes and no. As much as absolutely possible, every single report that we write based on a functional and visual evaluation has a whole page of educational accommodations. And that's honestly true whether they're in like a public school system or whether they, you know, they homeschool, because they still have the same needs. They're just sort of implemented differently. And so we encourage all of our patients to give that part of the report to parents. They, especially when it's time to like kind of get ready for their, you know, for their IEP, we very, very often will write letters to kind of update on the, you know, their present, you know, level of visual performance and sort of how they've improved or how they, you know, how they haven't. And, you know, in my experience, this is just, you know, my experience, but individual teachers are amazing at implementing things. The system isn't always so amazing, but that's, you know, That's just my experience. Now, beyond that, not really. You know, I practice in Florida, and in general, the school system is so under stress that they are not really actively looking for more things to think about. We try to coordinate with the school nurses as much as we can so that they're aware. We haven't made a ton of progress in that specific department. But individual teachers are amazing.
Well said. My question is, how functional vision problems and short attention span, how are they related? We kind of touched on that in the beginning of our conversation when we started, but how are they related?
Again, this is like super fascinating. So there's been some scientific research into the degree to which visual attention, being able to look at something for a sustained period of time, and mental attention, being able to pay attention to something for, you know, a sustained period of time. And they're absolutely not the same thing. But there is a very high degree of overlap in general. And when you help a child improve either one of those things, kind of both of them tend to improve. Like they're so interrelated that you can't affect one without the other. So that's sort of the foundation for the whole thing. But when it comes down to individual like actions, this is sort of my favorite way to think about this, because most people have never ever, they would have no reason to ever think about this. But two different parts. One, there's some other research that says that when kids, not just kids, adults, when they have poor eye movement control, tracking, you know, ocular motor function, like we've been talking about, they have a very hard time decoupling or, you know, separating when they are moving their eyes and looking at the world versus they're staying still and the world is moving. Like their brain has a really hard time knowing the difference. So, you know, if our patients, in addition to all of the other problems they have, also never are totally certain whether like the world's moving around them or whether they're moving or something else is happening, that's really kind of unsettling. And so they're often like distracted by that. And then another way that specifically will happen is, and this happens all the time, say I'm like looking at you, we're doing this over Zoom, and I want to kind of go over and shift my attention to look at my picture on the Zoom. But because my eyes aren't calibrated, I go a little bit too far. I kind of overshoot. And now I'm looking at my microphone. Well, that can feel to a patient, especially one who's got attention, you know, issues or ADHD, like the microphone just appeared out of nowhere and inserted itself into my awareness. And so now you are like ancient history, and I am like all into this microphone because it's like shiny. I'm no longer listening to what's going on because all of a sudden this is like right there. And that would have never happened if the eye movements were calibrated accurately. Now, there's all kinds of other things going on, but that interference, I mean, it happens all day, every day for these kids. It just happens. It's just like kind of watching TV and then somebody's just like beaming in every 30 seconds, like a whole different program. I mean, it's exhausting for them.
That's exhausting. Yes, 100% exhausting. As a parent, can my child receive special education services for a functional vision issue?
Well, kind of like I said, I mean, it's like school-based occupational therapists can be amazing like at this. It really depends on the issue. If it is ocular motor, they're fantastic at that. If it's like perceptual, they're fantastic at that. If it's some of the other things, like I said, where you really need tools and lenses and training, that's kind of more difficult for them. Usually, not always, but usually when we write these reports and we write these letters and we write these recommendations, they kind of are already identified and we are providing more ammo and more recommendations for accommodations. By the time they get to us, it's rare it's not impossible that we're like the very first ones who say, like, look, this child needs some, you know, additional assistance, attention, and this is what we recommend. So we definitely will, you know, advocate as best we can for the children, but just sort of due to the nature of human development, you know, where their skills are at, it's usually not until a little bit later to where vision really becomes critical. Now, of course, I mean, I think vision is critical from, like, you know, 6 months, but in terms of being identified, that's kind of how it tends to go.
Do you typically see an age range where kiddos are being identified?
Well, it depends. There are certain conditions like crossed eyes, which I would call esotropia, which, like, moms and grandparents, you know, like, see and they freak out about appropriately. And so that, you know, so we see them like really, really early. And so if they have additional problems, then those are all, like, you know, caught real early. But a lot of times it's, you know, really not until 9 or 10, you know, unless if somebody like you, you know, who's like really like in tune with these children and they're like, you know, you really got to have their eyes checked. I mean, it honestly takes somebody to have had this sort of knowledge to be like, yeah, you just got to like just make sure that that's fine. And sometimes it's totally fine. And I say, like, you're all good. Just keep plugging away, kiddo. You're going to be fine. But, you know, sometimes it's not that way.
Well, I hope from this podcast, somebody is getting some additional information and insight and will be able to help.
Can I say
continue
one thing?
That diagnosis? Absolutely.
This is one of the biggest paradoxes of my life. And I'm just going to say it and you can react to it. What I find is that the best, most dynamic, most wonderful, patient loving, student loving teachers have the worst classrooms for visual attention because they cram every single surface with something that's fascinating. You know, the walls, and, you know, I go into a classroom sometimes and the whiteboard is like 3/4 covered with amazing things. And so they have this tiny little piece that they write on, you know, there's like aquariums and then there's like tactile sensory stuff in the back. And it's impossible for kids to, not all kids, but for a lot of kids, it's just impossible to pay attention in that environment. And it's just a paradox because those are the best teachers. So you don't want to like discourage them. It's just very hard. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think it's very true. Very true. I think if Dr. Nate, if you teleported to the past, my classrooms, that's exactly what you would have seen. And I've taught kindergarten all the way up to post-secondary and it didn't matter what the age was. I had it all happening. So yes. What are some accommodations that you list in your report that perhaps somebody that may not have access to your knowledge could say, oh, that's something I could implement.
Right. So right off the bat, there's like the very kind of no-brainer things like preferential seating. You know, if it's hard for them to switch from the board to the, you know, to the desk, then if they're closer, then there's going to be fewer visual distractions and everything's going to look bigger and it's just going to be, you know, be easier. So that's, you know, obvious. Also, I will very, very often prescribe glasses and then they should just be used. But then again, that's like obvious to everybody. Ergonomics makes a giant difference. So we will very often recommend or issue slant boards. Now, you know, when I was a kid, our desks were all at a slight angle and that would promote good posture and it would sort of help kids stay at the right distance. Desks aren't like that. You know, I mean, my kids are 11 and 13 and they've never had basically like an ergonomic desk. And now my son has a computer built right into his desk. And so it's very challenging. So we will issue, like I said, slant boards. Very often they will take those to school and they will become part of their, you know, their work, you know, surface, you know, and that sorts of helps. One thing that sometimes creative teachers will do is they will take a sheet of paper and to be environmentally friendly, they will put it on 2 pieces of paper or sometimes even 4, you know, they'll shrink it down so it fits. But then the font gets like impossibly small, even for average, you know, mainstream kids. But for somebody who's got an auto-focusing problem, it becomes impossible. So we make sure that they don't use anything that's less than, you know, like roughly 14-point font, something like that, but not too small. You know, it becomes difficult. For earlier ages, we encourage using their finger to keep their place until they feel like they no longer need to. They probably won't need to do that forever, but a lot of teachers will discourage that because they want them to learn how to use their eyes independently, which is a reasonable thing. But if they're just not ready for it, then you're mostly just kind of frustrating with them. You can also use either like a bookmark or what we call a letterbox to isolate individual, words or sentences, and that sort of cuts down on that visual information overload. There's a certain thing, it's called the Harman distance, but we often call it the elbow distance. And basically what that means is if you make a fist and put it under your chin, you shouldn't hold anything visual closer than elbow distance. And as you get taller, that ratio stays roughly the same. And that's been validated a whole bunch of times, so that reduces long-term like eye strain and improved performance. But if you watch kids, I mean, they will get within like inches or sometimes even centimeters to the page. And that just causes, kind of lots of problems. So we just want teachers to know that they should kind of encourage that sort of posture. Not that that's possible to really fix that sort of, because that's like a really long, deep-seated, habit. So sort of be aware of that. And then of course, depending on the diagnosis, extra time for assignments and testing and time for additional breaks, that's, in my experience, that's gotten harder and harder to get even when it's appropriate, but we absolutely request it because it's appropriate.
Functional vision problems, are they related more to the eye or the brain?
So this is great because functional vision problems are 100% the brain and coordination and sensory integration and those sorts of things. Now, the other thing that I mentioned earlier, when we're talking about what I would call low vision, but what a lot of people would call, a teacher for the visually impaired or like a vision teacher, like those are people who are partially blind or have some sort of visual limitation, and that's from a disease or from a developmental, anomaly. So if they don't physically have the structures to be able to see either clearly or to see fully, they might have a restricted field of vision, or they might have other like reduced contrast, or there's a zillion different things. That's a hardware problem, and that's their eye. Everything else that we've talked about is their brain.
As we're kind of winding down our conversation today, and again, this has been so incredible and just what a pleasure and honor to have you with me today. What should I have asked that I didn't know enough to ask?
So this is something that is very, very challenging for parents, because I will go through the whole exam findings and I'll say, your child has 20/20 vision. They're not nearsighted. They're not farsighted. They don't have astigmatism. Everything is great about how their eyes are healthy and they can see really well. And then in the very next sentence, I'll say, and I'm going to prescribe these glasses for your child. And it is such a disconnect that now I'm a little bit more savvy than that, and I try to explain it ahead of time, but the glasses that we will often prescribe has nothing at all to do with seeing more clearly. Their eyes see plenty high res. That's totally fine. The glasses are designed for many of our patients that we're talking about, these sorts of students, to do some of the work for their eyes so they have more stamina and they can work longer without having the sort of symptoms, or their performance is better. And unlike my glasses, because I'm I've got a life sentence, I wear glasses all the time and I will for the rest of my life, these glasses are very often somewhat temporary. They may only use them for a year or two, and then as their visual skills improve, they may not really need them, or certainly not need them as much. They might need them for standardized testing, but they don't necessarily need them for 15 minutes of homework. But it's just so important for parents to be aware that we do prescribe glasses for lots of other reasons other than just improving clarity, and nobody knows that at all.
Well, thanks for sharing that. It's fascinating and it's great to know. My final question for us is always, you know, if you had a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why?
Right. And I thought about this a lot, you know, because a lot of times I have very like limited time to sort of talk to, you know, to parents. And this relates similarly to kind of what I was just saying, but vision is more than 2020. You know, I ask parents, like, what do you think 2020 is? And they'll be like, it's perfect vision. It's like everything there is. But in reality, it only takes us like 5 seconds to measure. Do they have 2020 vision? Yes, they can read those letters. Great. But it's so much more than that. It's not just that your eyes can see. It's that they can see easily and comfortably. And, you know, it starts at infancy where, you know, vision is movement. Vision is coordination. Vision is gross motor skills and fine motor skills. And all of the systems have to, you know, have to work together. And that's why every single patient I see, even if they're normal in every single way, middle of the bell curve in every single possible way, you know, I say, and it's really important to go outside and play. I joke sometimes about like, I'm going to start prescribing dogs because, you know, if they have dogs and they have to play with them and they've got to take them outside and they've got to go for walks and their eyes have to do all of these different things. And it's very difficult to be on, you know, an iPad or a phone while you're like paying attention to your dog. And, you know, that's because our visual systems grow and develop through movement and interaction. And it's way, way more than just 2020. So that's my billboard.
Excellent final advice. I love it. And thank you again for this tremendous conversation. And I'm excited to have our listeners digest it. And I'm sure some are furiously taking notes as they're listening to this and to kind of go on and help support kiddos in the future. So I really appreciate your time today.
Well, it was an honor to be here. I enjoyed it so much. You do so much fantastic work, you know, for both parents and professionals. I mean, it's just really, really important and I'm happy to do it.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.